Hello there. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, our first story is entitled China Wants Taiwan. Recent belligerent actions raise fears that China may try to seize Taiwan by force. What would happen? What has China been doing to stir things up in that part of the world? The Chinese military routinely rehearses an invasion of Taiwan and has even created a life-size mock-up of the presidential building for its bombers to practice targeting. That sounds serious, doesn't it? Chinese warplanes intrude into Taiwan's airspace so frequently that the island, with its much smaller military, cannot afford to scramble its jets in response every time the Chinese mainland makes an overture. In the past few months, Beijing has dramatically scaled up these provocations by sending an aircraft carrier group to the island and flying some 25 fighter jets and bombers into Taiwanese airspace in a single day. And because Beijing will host the Winter Olympics in early 2022, few analysts believe at this time that an invasion is likely this year. But U.S. military leaders predict a possible takeover attempt within the next 6 years. That would pose a huge problem for the U.S. While Washington severed formal ties with the island in 1979 to establish relations with China, it has no defense treaty with Taiwan. A law requires that the U.S. ensure that Taiwan can defend itself. And so President Biden last week dispatched a delegation of U.S. officials to Taipei in a show of support. And Secretary of State Blinken warned that it would be a very serious mistake for anyone to try to change the existing status quo by force. But just why does China want Taiwan? It lies just 80 miles from the Chinese mainland, and Taiwan was part of China for centuries. It was then occupied by Japan from 1895 until the end of World War II. And after Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party won the China Civil War in 1949, U.S. ally Chiang Kai-shek fled to the island and he set up a rival Republic of China. But Beijing has always considered it a renegade province. When the UN admitted China in 1971, it kicked Taiwan out. And ever since, the US has held to a carefully worded doctrine that both sides of the Taiwanese Strait are one China, leaving ambiguous which side is the legitimate government. President Xi Jinping wants his legacy to be the restoration of Greater China with total control over Taiwan and Hong Kong and the ethnic minority provinces of Tibet and Xinjiang. He has explicitly threatened the use of force to reclaim Taiwan. Why would the U.S. intervene, should he do so? For one thing, Taiwan is the world's top maker of advanced semiconductors, and Washington does not want to see Beijing seize control of that critical technology. Then, too, Taiwan is a vibrant democracy in a region that has few. China's recent assertion of control over Hong Kong, which has seen its freedom drastically curtailed, shows that Taiwan's 24 million people would be badly repressed should China gain control. For the U.S., losing Taiwan would be a crippling blow to American prestige. To abandon our commitment to Taiwan's de facto independence would be a diplomatic earthquake, so to speak, on a par with the 1956 British loss of the Suez Canal, which in fact signaled the end of the empire. China would effectively replace the U.S. as the world's predominant superpower. Just why is China acting up now? China fears that the goal of reunification may be getting farther away. The Taiwanese president has not explicitly called for formal independence, something that only 32% of Taiwanese would support. The president of Taiwan has begun trying to lessen the country's dependence on mainland trade. The U.S. has sold Taiwan billions of dollars of weapons over the years, including a $5 billion shipment last year alone. And China may feel that the best time to act is soon, before Taipei can strengthen its military. Chinese aggression in other arenas with very little pushback has also likely emboldened Chinese military leaders to think more seriously about Taiwan. How would an invasion occur if China decides to move on the island? Beijing could blockade Taiwan, depriving it of oil, gas, and food until it surrenders. Or it could launch a massive surprise attack, overwhelming the island before the U.S. could send help. First, cyber strikes could cripple U.S. satellites monitoring Chinese missile launches. Then bombers could destroy command centers while paratroopers swooped in to establish a beachhead for tens of thousands of soldiers to land. If the People's Liberation Army got boots on the ground fast in Taiwan, the takeover could be a fait accompli, and the U.S. would face a decision about whether to go to war with a nuclear-armed foe halfway around the world, or what other strategy? A military conflict with China, no matter how it ended, would be devastating to both economies. Both heavily dependent on trade with each other. China has other territorial ambitions, and we'll end this item about Taiwan by summarizing where else China has its eyes in the local area. Since Xi Jinping became president in 2013, China has been exerting its internationally contested claim to fisheries and to mineral resources in nearly the entire South China Sea, and doing so by building artificial islands and stationing military equipment on them. Neither the Obama nor the Trump administration pushed back against China for that in any meaningful way. And China is now loudly insisting on its sovereignty over the islands, which have long been claimed by the Philippines, Vietnam, Japan, and others. A Chinese Coast Guard vessel rammed and sank a Vietnamese fishing vessel near the Paracel Islands, which both countries claim. And then last month, Beijing deployed a militia fleet near the Philippines, prompting the Biden administration to send an aircraft carrier unit and an assault ship and warn of an armed attack on any Philippine vessel would trigger our obligations under the Mutual Defense Treaty, thus forcing China to back down at that time. This time, they backed down. But the future is problematic. More about this in the not too distant future. Let's go to New England. The next item of business today, I want to tell you about New England's England. Well, New England has six towns called Warren, one in each state. But the reason for these place names is much more complicated than you might think, and more complicated than we can talk about today. But the second most popular name in New England, other than Warren, is Bristol. It's the name of towns in New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, and Rhode Island. Also a city in Connecticut, and counties in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. They were named after Bristol, England, in the West Country of England. If you've ever been to England, you might have taken the train to that area, to Bath or to Liverpool or places in that area. Many more place names in New England come from places in England, and let me give you just a few of these. Massachusetts, for example, has the most, with at least 104 English names for cities, towns, and counties. It starts with Amesbury, and it ends with Yarmouth. Rhode Island has the fewest of the English place names, 15 of them, from Bradford to Wickford. Maine has 32, Vermont 36, Connecticut 31, including Hartford. Also, New Hampshire was named after the county of Hampshire in England, in southern England. It was named by John Mason, the colony's first proprietor, though he never set foot in New England. New Hampshire has 47 English names for cities, towns, and counties. The historian Kevin Phillips points out that many of the English names in New England came from the southeastern part of the country. And that is, as you may know, is called East Anglia. Anglo invaders from Western Denmark arrived there in the 6th century and later mingled with their Saxon neighbors. And that, my friends, is New England's England. Of all of the regions of the United States, England, you might say, is the most densely populated by English place names indicating its ancestry. I'm going to talk about George Washington Carver's research today, and it was much more than just peanuts. And so we might call this part of the program the sustainable part. No American is more closely associated with peanuts than George Washington Carver, who developed hundreds of uses for them, from Worcestershire sauce to shaving cream to paper. But our insatiable curiosity for peanuts, according to scholars, has obscured Carver's greatest agricultural achievement, and that is to help Black farmers prosper free of the tyranny of cotton. He was born enslaved in Missouri around 1864. And he then trained in Iowa as a botanist. And Carver took over the agricultural department at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama in 1896. His hope was to aid Black farmers, most of whom were cotton sharecroppers, and they were trapped in perpetual debt to white plantation owners. He said, "I came here solely for the benefit of my people." And he worked to achieve this. He found that cotton had stripped the region's soil of its nutrients, and yet landowners were prohibiting Black farmers from planting food crops. So Carver began experimenting with plants like peanuts and sweet potatoes, which could replenish the nitrogen that cotton leached. And grown discreetly, they could also help farmers feed their families. In classes and at conferences and at county fairs, George Washington Carver showed often packed crowds how to raise these crops. And since his death in 1943, many of the practices that Carver advocated, such as organic fertilizer, reusing food waste, and crop rotation, have become crucial to the sustainable agriculture movement. Mark Hersey, a historian at Mississippi State University, says Carver's most prescient innovation was a truly holistic approach to farming. Well before there was an environmental justice movement, Black environmental thinkers connected land exploitation and racial exploitation. A true accounting of American conservation would put Carver at the very forefront. I hope you're a fan of New Orleans jazz, because my next story today is about Kid Ory. His pioneering trombone work put New Orleans jazz on the map, but only now is Kid Ory getting the encore that he deserves. If you were sauntering through the packed dirt streets of back of town New Orleans in the 1910s, anywhere between Storyville and Girttown, chances are you would have encountered several brass bands blowing a new flavor of music from wagons that promoted upcoming performances. But none of them blew like Kid Ory's band. Kid Ory wowed onlookers by stretching his trombone slide over the tailgate and blasting competing groups with his signature goodbye tune, "Do What Ory Say," as the crowd cheered. Kid Ory's band would cut all of the bands during his tailgate advertising, said Louis Armstrong, who marveled at Kid Ory's virtuosity. The origins of jazz have always been murky. While the early 1900s bandleader and cornetist Buddy Bolden is often credited with pioneering the hot improvisational brass music that became jazz, Kid Ory is largely remembered as a sideman for stars like Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton. His status as one of the most pivotal bandleaders in jazz, who helped popularize the trombone glissando, a central element of New Orleans jazz, has receded from the popular memory. Yet it was Kid Ory who prepared the ground for the work of nearly all subsequent New Orleans jazz musicians, and who arguably brought jazz into its modern form through his charismatic, innovative playing and his dogged, business-minded band leading. Remembering Kid Ory as a sideman is like talking about Duke Ellington as a pianist. Ory's instrument really was the band. But jazz's greatest glissandeur is now being remembered more fully, because for the first time, the public can now visit Woodland Plantation in Laplace, Louisiana, the former 1,800-acre sugarcane operation 29 miles up the Mississippi from New Orleans, where Edward Kid Ory was born in 1886. As it happened, Ory's childhood home was also where the largest uprising of enslaved people in U.S. history originated, the famous revolt of 1811. And now, friends, it's time to think about leaving for the day. We're at the end of our program. I want to thank you for tuning in. It's a pleasure to have you. I want you to please be safe until we meet again next week. Remember, wear your mask, keep your social distance, please take your shots, get vaccinated so we can get back to our normal lives. But you have a good day. Come back to hear a little of this, a little of that. I'll be waiting for you. So now it's time for my friend Willie Nelson to take us out of here as we go down the road again, looking for items for a little of this, a little of that.